ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
I'm glad you're listening to the 47th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I've got a real treat for you this week. You'll get to hear my interview with Jeff Lemire, comics creator of such great things including Sweet Tooth, Animal Man, most recently Frankenstein Agent of Shade, and coming in the future, Justice League Dark. You'll be interested to hear the things that he has to say. After that, I'll review this week's comics. Then Gianluca Glazer and Ian Cullen join me for this week's news and previews. Everything wraps up with a peek inside your local store, including something that Jeff Lemire talks about. Since there's a lot going on, let's get to it. I want to welcome to the podcast today Jeff Lemire, comic creator of Animal Man and Sweet Tooth, Frankenstein Agent of Shade, and moving into Justice League Dark. How are you doing today, Jeff?
Oh, I'm doing great, thanks.
Great. We were talking a little bit before I started recording this about how you got into comics. Can you tell that story again? I really liked what you were saying about that.
I'll try to I don't know if it might come out different this time. But
that's okay.
Yeah, I was basically saying how making a career in comics was never something that I really aspired to or expected. The analogy I used was that it's like if you're a kid playing baseball, you dream of playing in the major leagues, but you never really think that that's a reality. So for me, making a living doing comics was never something that was even a possibility. And really, I just did it. I went to film school and thought that maybe I'd get involved in that. But I became really disillusioned just with the film industry, and I just felt like the kind of stories I wanted to tell, I'd be much better suited working in a medium like comics where you can put your ideas right down on a page and they come out pretty much exactly how you want them. You don't have to filter it through actors and all these different crew members and things. It just seemed much more suited to my personality. So, you know, after school, this would have been, I guess we're getting on 10 or 15 years ago now, I just started drawing every day and making comics. And again, it wasn't with the expectation of trying to make a career out of it. It was really just what I did. It was my outlet. And I always anticipated that I just have to work day jobs. And my comics would be my passion, but that's what I would do on the side. And I just started self-publishing stuff and then gradually moved on to some of the smaller independent publishers in the States, like Top Shelf. You know, and then things started to get a bit more serious in terms of me coming to the realization that maybe I could actually make some money doing this as well as doing it for love. I could actually possibly supplement my income. And then when I moved over to DC and Vertigo and stuff, it became a reality. And I've been making a full-time living doing comics now for about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, it's a dream come true. But again, the career aspect was never something I really spent too much effort thinking about. It was always the work first, and I guess everything else kind of came as a result of me just focusing on the work and doing the best stuff that I could.
Great. Well, you may be getting tired of hearing this, but I just wanted to congratulate you on the success you're having with Animal Man and Frankenstein and moving into Justice League Dark. It's just been so great to hear people talk about Animal Man. I like to say you're taking Buddy Baker where no Animal Man has gone before.
That character is... He has such an avid fan base because of the Grant Morrison run. But I knew when I took on the character, if I tried to repeat the stuff that Grant had done on it, that I was doomed just to be compared to him. And I really had to do my own thing with it. So I really took some chances and tried to move it in a new direction. And I'm really overwhelmed by the response. And it's been pretty amazing. I haven't really had a book that's resonated with the readership the way Animal Man has. And obviously it's providing me with a lot of new opportunities. So I couldn't be more excited.
Yeah, that's great, because even to this day, there are more and more people picking up the book for the first time. One of the gentlemen I do the broadcast with, he just started buying the books. And my brother, who had bought a couple and hadn't read many, now he's hooked on it too. So it just seems like it's just getting to be more and more people into it.
Yeah, there's this weird, it just seems to keep growing, whereas most books after the first issue, their readership declines. Animal Man seems to be going in the other direction, which is very strange, but obviously very exciting.
Well, it must be pretty cool, because as the word of mouth continues to grow, and it was strong to start, it just seems to be getting bigger and bigger as we go along.
Yeah, for sure.
You're right. This is not how things normally go. Things normally start big and then fade down.
Yeah.
But one thing that you all in New 52 have been doing is it seems to me you all are gaining steam as we go along. I mean, Scott's Batman storyline, and it's just doing real well. And it just seems like Justice League and everybody, the numbers seem to be going up, which is a great thing to see. And it's very unusual. So I really think that's, you know, you deserve to be congratulated. You may be getting tired of hearing that by now.
But. No, it's certainly an exciting thing to be a part of the whole New 52. Before it started and I first heard about it, I was, you know, probably as skeptical as everyone else because I had sort of my favorite characters, my favorite books and things, and change can be kind of scary. And then when I started working on things like Animal Man and Frankenstein and stuff and realized the amount of freedom I would have to kind of make these things my own, it became really exciting. And I think that just translates down to the fans and they pick up on that. And I don't know, it's a very exciting time to be a part of DC Comics, that's for sure.
That's great. I'm glad that you're getting to do Animal Man because it's such a great read. So much fun. You said something interestingly about Animal Man for Valentine's Day and his wife. And I quote a little bit of what you said in there because I just found it really interesting. To me, Buddy may be the superhero, but Ellen is the strong one. He may wear the costume, but she's the rock of the Baker clan. Truth is, Buddy's actually a bit of a flake. One day he's a stuntman. The next day he's an indie film actor. The next he's flying around San Diego in tights and a mask. Yet Ellen is always there supporting him and picking up the slack at home. I think that's such a cool thing to say about that. The point I was interested in asking you about is the family aspect of Animal Man. Mm. You know, you could call it the animal family, basically, because...
Buddy Baker, Animal Man, isn't really the star of the book. All four members of the family are really the star, and it's really what makes that book unique and makes it stand out. There really aren't any other modern-day superheroes who have families or who have children or wives that are really actively a part of the book and treated as equals in the cast. Most of the time, they're just throwaway. If they do have a wife or something, it's kind of just a throwaway plot device, and they're not really involved in the adventures and the actual plot and stuff, but that's always what made Grant Morrison's stuff unique, and I think it's what a lot of people are latching onto now. It's someone we can all relate to, you know. Many of the readers now are older and they have families and stuff. They can actually relate to what Buddy's going through as opposed to most superheroes who are leading these fantastic lives that are pretty far from what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Another member of the family I want to talk about is Maxine. One of the things you make clear in the book is that she's actually more in tune with the Red than even Buddy is.
Yes.
And I find that to be really interesting. A young daughter, comics tend to be more of a male-oriented medium. And so here you are bringing Ellen in, as she's the more stable of the bunch. You've got Maxine, who's more in tune with the source of Buddy's powers than even he is. And I just find that interesting that you're highlighting a lot the women in the family. And
yeah, I mean, so many of the female characters in comics today are... You know, they're pretty two-dimensional. They're either there for sex appeal or, you know, it's there's not a lot of really real women being portrayed in comics, especially Ellen, who's a really strong, great character, but she never wears a costume or doesn't have any superpowers or anything. I think it's pretty unique. And so you just try to take advantage of that and make them all as real as you can. And again, it just goes back to what makes that book unique. And what makes it unique isn't Buddy and his animal powers. It's the relationship between the different family members and the dynamic. And the effect that sort of the fantastic elements of Buddy's life have on that family is kind of really what it's about. In order to do that, you have to make all four members as real as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found it interesting that Maxine's the one that's in tune instead of her brother. Because, you know, normally the men in the family are the superheroes and the women are sort of standing around cheering them on. That's why it was such a great thing. And I think it surprised a lot of people when Maxine had those kinds of powers. So many people kept saying to me, I can't believe what he's doing with the daughter. I mean, Buddy is interesting and he's a great character, but Maxine is the one that seems to be able to rescue her own father from danger from the rot. That's such a great commentary on family living, as you're right, in an industry that doesn't really focus on the family very often.
Yeah, it's true. And I think there's something really interesting about the superhero of the book actually being the one that needs to be saved from his daughter or his wife all the time. And just trying to do whatever you can to make this book unique and make it different from the other dozens and dozens of superhero comics that come out every week. So I'm just, again, thrilled that it seems to actually be working and resonating with people. And it's very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have an annual coming up, and you want to talk a little bit about that?
Really exciting. I mean, it was kind of something that came out of nowhere. I didn't have it planned or anything, and they said I could do it. The best part is that it's almost 50 pages, so it's,
wow.
In many ways, it's like this little graphic novel, you know, a self-contained thing, and I could really do pretty much anything I wanted with it. So I just took it as the opportunity to really build on the mythology that Scott Snyder and I are creating with The Rot, and I thought it'd be a good opportunity to kind of show the red and the green struggle with the rod at a different point in history. So we're actually going to see a different panel land on a different swamp thing from the past together, fighting the rod. And obviously, it'll have implications and reveal information and stuff that will be important to Buddy and Alec Holland moving forward.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. This is coming out in May?
Yeah, May. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a different artist. Timothy Green is doing the art on
that. Yeah, he's fantastic. My God, I can't wait for people to see what he's been doing. I just got some pages, some new pages yesterday, and they're really amazing. Travel Foreman, the artist on the monthly book, he added a lot to the book and the success of the book, and his sort of visual imagination was really great and really unique and helped to build the world and stuff. But I think Timothy has that same big imagination and a really unique quality to his work where when you look at it, it almost feels like it's something you haven't seen before. So mm-hmm. I think he's going to be a great fit for the team.
Now, you also have Steve Pugh helping on the book as well.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Grant Morrison stuff, but probably more so I was actually a fan of the Jamie Delano run in the 90s, and Steve drew that. So when Travel was having some problems with deadlines, I suggested Steve and was really happy when he agreed to do it. And now he's kind of coming on as the regular monthly artist as Travel's decided to move on to some new things. So it's really fun to be working with one of these guys who kind of helped create the character that I was so inspired by. You know?
Mm-hmm. I like Steve's work on Hotwire, for instance. So I had a chance to interview him, and he's very excited about all these good things. So it's great to see him actually doing a monthly title again. And
yeah, I'm so glad he's back, too. I think a lot of for whatever reason, his stuff isn't talked about a lot today, you know, whereas some of the other artists from the 80s and 90s are remembered quite fondly. His stuff doesn't seem to resonate with modern readers the same way. So I'm glad he's coming back, and he's going to get a chance to show off to a whole new generation of comic readers.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is you actually have a T-shirt coming out.
Yeah.
That says Evolve or Die on it, and it's got Travel's art on there. Do you want to talk a little about how that came to be?
Yeah, well, for those who have read the series, the first issue kind of opened with this fake magazine interview with Buddy Baker where he talks about his career up until that point. And in that article, you get the sense that Buddy's become kind of like a counterculture icon for the young college crowd, where his politics about animal rights and veganism and things like that have sort of resonated with the younger people. And he's kind of become almost like a folk hero. And I hint in that article that there's these bootleg T-shirts that kids are wearing, you know, and stuff like that. And when Bob Chapman from Graffiti Designs, I met him at New York Comic Con last fall, and he was really anxious to do something with Animal Man because of the popularity of the book, and we talked, and it just seems obvious that the T-shirt that people were wearing in the book should be the T-shirt that he made, so we kind of worked together to get that done, and that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. It's really exciting to read Animal Man and to see the surprises that come from month to month. I really like it a lot. But before we leave the book, you said something that's kind of cryptic in that same thing about Valentine's Day, talking about Ellen. And I want to see if I can get you to elaborate just a little bit. Don't spoil anything. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. You said that how much more of the craziness can Ellen endure? When Buddy keeps putting the kids in danger, I wonder where Ellen will draw the line. He said that may be a question that'll be answered sooner rather than later. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Not specifically, but it just seems to me as a parent that if your partner was doing things or involved in things that were as crazy as the stuff that Buddy does, there would be a line where once it starts affecting your children and once it starts putting your family in danger, you'd have to take a stand. And Ellen seems to me like the person who would support Buddy, but not to the point of it where her children are being threatened. And I think we're nearing that point for her. We're really going to start to see that in issues 7, 8, 9, 10, where she's reaching her breaking point of what she can handle and what she can put up with. And I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but there's going to come a point with this family where they either have to deal with what's happening to them and face the rot and all this stuff. And it's either going to destroy them as a family or they're going to somehow come out of it and become stronger. So that's really, you know, what the book's about.
Mm-hmm. Again, this goes back to the family dynamic and the notion of the superhero family. It's great to explore these kind of things because this is the kind of stuff that happens in real lives. You know, the father may like to go out and hunt or something, but when the hunting starts to become a problem at home, then the mother's got to put her foot down and say, you know, you will not endanger the rest of the family with that. So this is stuff we can all relate to, and I like that.
Yeah, the goal is to take all the more fantastic supernatural and horror elements in the book. They should all really just be metaphors for things that a regular family would go through, sort of exaggerated versions of maybe real life problems. And if you can keep that in mind and then have the family members react accordingly, I think you kind of have it anchored in real life enough that people can accept all the fantastic elements and not be distracted by them.
Mm-hmm. I bought all the New 52, so I was glad I was able to read Animal Man. I also read Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, which I know you're leaving, but mm-hmm. in some senses, I'm really sorry you're going to go because you did some really interesting things with the Frankenstein book. You often thought visually, which a lot of comics people don't do, and there's one example I like to point out is where Frankenstein's underwater and he's with another member of the team, and they turn the light on. When they turn the light on, instead of being something equal in size to them, there's this huge sea creature in front of them. And I went, whoa, when I saw that, because oftentimes comics don't think big enough visually. They'll think, you know, the light will come on and there'll be somebody in front of them, and that's startling enough. But when you see this huge thing in front of them, I just was like shocked.
That was a really fun book. For me, Animal Man and then Sweet Tooth are both such, I mean, they're very serious books and they're very intense, and emotionally they take a lot out of me to write them and stuff. So Frankenstein was almost my anecdote where once a month I could just sit down and write really fun science fiction stories. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I had a blast writing that book, and I'm sad to go too, but Justice League Dark was an opportunity that I just couldn't pass up because my fondness for characters like John Constantine and Zatanna and Deadman, the chance to write them was something I couldn't pass up. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, because you lead right into what I want to talk about with Justice League Dark, is that you're going to get to play with some more of the supernatural characters.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a lot of fun, I'm sure, because some of the setup has been done by Peter Milligan as far as the team goes, but you're adding a new character.
Yeah, there are actually three new characters, two of which were revealed on the cover solicitation last week. So Black Orchid and Eye Vampire are joining the team, and there's also a third member who I'm not going to... Well,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You're gonna tease us, and we got to buy the book to find out. I can go for that. So, as far as Justice League Dark, do you have any direction you want to go with the book?
Oh yeah, I have a big storyline plotted out. But again, that's something I'm not even going to tease yet because I don't want to give anything away. But at the end of the first issue, it'll become pretty clear where I'm headed.
What's it like to do with one of the Justice League books? Because now there are three of them basically. There's Justice League, and then there's International and Dark.
Yeah.
Is that something you were kind of hoping to do, is be involved with the Justice League book?
I didn't really aspire to that or anything. To me, I just kind of seek out characters that I like and stuff, and those supernatural characters have always been kind of my favorite in the DC stable. So, but the bonus of it is that I get to kind of be a part of the Justice League universe. And one of the things when I took over Justice League Dark that I felt wasn't really established in Pete Milligan's run was why Justice League is in the title of that book, because mm-hmm. it's sort of this collection of oddball characters, but there really isn't any tangible connection to what Geoff Johns is doing in Justice League or International. So I thought it would be fun to create a link and to show why this group of magical misfits mm-hmm. has Justice League in the title and make it more literal. So Geoff Johns and I actually did have quite a few conversations, including one last night that went well into the evening, but mm-hmm. we kind of have a big story plotted out where we're kind of hoping to bring those three Justice League titles a bit closer together and kind of maybe a unity between them. And all three teams are so different that that's really going to be a lot of fun. So you will see it again in my first issue. You'll see immediately an explanation of the title and their connection to Geoff's team.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the great things about the New 52, and by giving like you exposure in the books that you're doing, these books actually made me go back and pick up Sweet Tooth. And so I'm catching up on that. And I wanted to talk with you briefly about that, because this is the way I think mutants, and I'm not certain that these characters are mutants and they're like us, but I always thought a mutant shouldn't be a teen model. You know, it shouldn't look like somebody who is on the cover of a magazine. It should look more like what Gus is. Gus is a very different looking character. And I just thought that when I saw that and I started to read the story, I thought, this is the way this mutants should be done. It should be done right like this. And it's interesting that you also draw many of the issues for this. And I find that an interesting mix. There's not a lot of writer-artists around these days.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I was just curious, where did the concept for Sweet Tooth come from?
It's probably a big mishmash of a whole bunch of different influences, but I've always loved post-apocalyptic stories, and I really wanted to do one, but kind of treat it sort of in a much quieter, character-driven way. And another one of my favorite books was always Jack Kirby's Commandy series, and I was rereading that, and there's just a lot of really rich ideas in there about human-animal hybrids and The Last Boy on Earth and things like that, and I think that kind of mixed into it as well. So it's hard to remember now, because I've been working on the book for 4 years or something, where those original ideas came from. But I think it was probably a mix of a bunch of different things.
Well, I really like it, and I really enjoy the fact that Gus, the first time he leaves the home, he ends up going out with Mr. Jeffords, and what happens is he gets betrayed by him. He trusts this man, and of course, he just assumes, based on his father, that everybody's going to treat him that way. And he ends up in this terrible place, terrible things happening to him. And as the story progresses along, when Jeffords comes back to him, it's going to take a while for that relationship to mend. But one of the things that interests me most is Jeffords' affection, basically, for Gus. We find out who Jeffords' son is, which was a shock to me. I was very surprised by that. But I was glad it wasn't Gus, that Gus wasn't his son. That would have been a little obvious.
Yeah.
But to see Jeffords now sort of adopt Gus and treat him like a son, again, you're talking about this notion of family, in that Jeffords takes Gus under his wing as somebody who's a son character to him. Is that going to be kind of a theme going forward? Are we going to see these different groups interact like that?
Yeah, I mean, that book is really all about their relationship, and Gus starts off as the literal embodiment of complete innocence, where he's sort of a half animal, half child, which is really the two most innocent things there are, and Jeffords is the exact opposite. He's someone who's been through so much in his life and just been hardened by it, and now he lives this cold, violent existence. And then as the two interact and more they get to know each other, we start to see them both becoming more like the other, and the father-son relationship, obviously, grows and grows, and that I don't want to give away where things are heading, but that's really the main drive of the book for sure.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about is your artistic rendering of Gus, the way that he looks. He's got a deer sort of look, even to his face, as well as the antlers. And I always think that makes him a much more sympathetic character, because we sort of feel for animals like that, and to see a person who has resemblance to that, I think right away feel sorry or feel sympathy for him. So when he suffers, I got angry at Jeffords when he deserts Gus, and I was so mad at him. And when I saw him in the book again, I looked and I said, why is he back here? He's done this terrible thing to Gus, and yet here he is still going on in the book. But you know, the great thing about it was you were eliciting that kind of emotion from me, and yet as we move along, I feel for Jeffords now, now that we've discovered what happened to his wife and everything that's been going on with that. So this is a great book because we relate to the people. Even though they're unusual characters, we can still feel for them in really interesting ways, and I just think you're doing a great job with that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what I was talking about with Animal Man, where you have really fantastic elements, either science fiction elements or horror elements or whatever that are going on in these books, but really they're all just metaphor for real life things, and if you kind of keep that in mind and treat the characters as real people, and despite how fantastic their surroundings may be, I think it just resonates a lot more with readers.
Mm-hmm. When I heard you in New York, I was at New York Comic Con, and you and Scott were on a panel talking about the Animal Man Swamp Thing relationship, and you started to mention about the fact that this has been a crossover actually since the first issues of each book. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? I mean, when you knew you were going to do Animal Man and Scott knew he was going to do Swamp Thing, was this something conscious, or were you just talking about things and it just sort of evolved out of your discussions? How did this happen?
Yeah, it just kind of evolved into something like he got his book and I got mine, and we just sat down to write a crossover. And it was more like he was working on his book and I was working on mine, and we just share scripts and give each other feedback and advice and things like that when we run into a problem. So we were just doing that, and we just started to realize, as we got into second, third scripts of each series, there was just so much common ground between what each of us were doing thematically, and it just seemed clear that at some point we had to bring things together. And then once that kind of clicked in our head and we kind of knew where we wanted to go with it, then we started actively drawing connections between the two books and things like that. So it's a crossover that's coming in issue 12, and we'll go for a little while, but it's unlike a lot of comic book superhero crossovers or whatever. This isn't one where the editorial came to us and said, you have to have this character appear in your book to boost sales this month. It was more Scott and I just as friends and creators talking about story and just naturally building something together. So I think it's going to be something really great, and we're both super excited about it.
Great. Now, can I sneak in one last question? Is that when I look at Alec Holland and I look at Buddy Baker, now granted this is comics, and yet they sort of resemble each other. Is there any kind of, I don't know what to say, if they're, I don't want to go all X-Men and have them be brothers twice removed on their father's side, kind of stuff. But is there any kind of relationship or similarity between them? Or if you can't answer that, then I'll understand.
No, I can, because there isn't. I think any physical resemblance is just coincidence. But if anything, if there's two characters that are sort of connected and similar, it'll end up being Maxine and Alec, not Buddy and Alec. So.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? That's really good. Well, I am so enjoying what you're doing, and just keep more of the same. It's just excellent
stuff. Thank you very
much. That you're doing. And, you know, I would wish you much success, except I think you're getting a lot of success. And I'd wish you even more, because I want to keep reading what you're doing. So keep up the great work, and you're justifying everything I ever thought about the New 52 and making it a big hit. So.
Well, great. I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate it, Jeff. And hopefully when things come in the future, maybe after Justice League Dark's been up for a little while, we can talk a little more.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate talking with you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot.
Did you come to Earth for the music and stay for the science fiction? Join a guided tour of the minds that make science fiction great. Get on our cosmic double-decker tour bus at www.balticonpodcast.org and see all the sights. Coming up on our right, Time Shifted for your viewing pleasure, are fascinating interviews with writers, fans, and scientists. Streaming in on our left are author readings, con-going tips, and essays. And at the end of the tour, there's always more of that great music that brought you here in the first place. So climb aboard, strap in, and hold on to your petty palps. It's the Balticon Podcast Tour to the ends of space and time.
www.balticonpodcast.org.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Wayne's Comic Review.
Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands. And now, another exciting episode.
Let's take a look at the comics that came out this past week. The book of the week for me was Atomic Robo, The Ghost of Station X, number 5 of 5. I always love this book. It's such a great comic. Teaches a little science as well as has some fun and adventure to it. Brian Clevenger does the scripting and Scott Wagner does the art, as always. This is a great miniseries because Robo gets all over the world. He's in space, he's in different parts of the planet, and he's got a lot going on. We come to find out what's been happening all 5 issues in this book, so you're going to want to be sure to read this. I'm sure it'll come out in trade. If you've missed it so far, go back and get the trade and read it from the start. Heck, go back and buy all these trades. There's a lot of them that they've done. They tend to do these in miniseries, so don't miss it. Atomic Robo is always a great comic. As far as the New 52 reviews, I thought that the Flash number 6 was really great. He comes up against a much stronger version of Captain Cold. Batman the Dark Knight number 6 also has the Flash in it, but the big bad of the issue was Bane, who's out to finish the job he started when he broke Batman's back. Meanwhile, Aquaman number 6 has Mira dealing with humans on her own for the first time, and it's not pretty. Teen Titans has the team trying to recover from their battle with Superboy. Next, I enjoyed Superman, as the world fears what seems to be the Man of Steel gone bad. The Savage Hawkman explores the properties of Nth Metal. Justice League Dark shows what's keeping that group of disparate characters together at the moment. Also, Green Lantern New Guardians number 6 has that group fighting a godlike being. The Fury of Firestorm continues to improve, with the two Firestorms dealing with disaster in very different ways. The miniseries The Ray number 3 continues to be an engaging comic, with an evil filmmaker attacking the hero. Isn't that something different? All-Star Western has Jonah Hex meeting the Wayne family in Gotham. Voodoo number 6 keeps moving to the character's origin. iVampire has Batman back again, so that's going real well. The weakest for me of the bunch of the New 52 is Blackhawks, and I guess I can understand why they're taking this book down after a few more issues. Still, I hate to see anything go down. Other books that I thought were worth picking up this week were American Vampire number 24 from DC, Avengers Academy number 26, and Dorothy and the Wizard in Oz number 5 of 8 from Marvel. Morning Glories number 16 from Image, Incorruptible 27 from Boom Studios, Sixth Gun number 19 from Oni Press, and Jim Butcher's Dresden Files Full Moon number 5 from Dynamite. And those are the books that came out this week.
Okay. Okay, time for this week's news and previews. And with me this week, as always, is Ian Cullen. How are you, Ian?
I'm good.
And Gianluca Glazer. How are you, Gianluca?
I'm doing swell.
Okay. A word that Superman likes in the movies. Let's go ahead and start with Ian. Ian's got some stuff he wants to talk about. So, Ian, why don't we start with you?
Well, right away, this is something that's been coming up quite a bit over the last few months due to the poor state of the economy and whatnot. But Archie Comics are going to do a book that's inspired by the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
This last week, they promoted some artwork from Jill Thompson depicting similar protests in the town of Riverdale. The company hasn't revealed what issue this new storyline will be seen in, but is expected to run sometime after May, since full solicitation information is not available until the end of that month. So that's kind of interesting. But one thing that I was mentioning before we started recording very briefly, it's been continually coming up, but it doesn't seem to be affecting the publication of the books. But the Edgar Bryce Burroughs estate, as in, I think it's his grandchildren or great-grandchildren, well, might be great-grandchildren, because Tarzan was written in, what, 1910? They've actually sent a lawsuit to Dynamite Entertainment regarding what they see to be trademark infringement because of John Carter of Mars and the Lord of the Jungle books, which is based on Tarzan, obviously. And yet, the bizarre thing is, I've got Tarzan bookmarked on my Google Alerts, and I'm getting this like every couple of hours every day. Mm-hmm. It's coming up, you know, with a new take on it. And John Luca, I think you and I briefly touched on it in email last week when it first came out.
Sure. Yeah.
And you said that any self-respecting judge would probably throw this out of court anyway.
I think the judge will rule in Dynamite's favor. There's like a few reasons for that. It does set a dangerous precedent if they do rule in favor of the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What makes you think that it's going to be thrown out?
Well, the reason why is because the name John Carter of Mars is trademarked. So is Tarzan. But the actual stories from Edgar Rice Burroughs and the characters in the stories are all public domain. Same with Sherlock Holmes. People can do a Sherlock story. People can do a Tarzan story. But as long as they don't infringe upon those trademarks, that's fine. I kind of see the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate doing this because Dynamite is making a lot of money off of these two titles. I don't even think Disney works with the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate with their John Carter movie either. That's the other thing. I know Marvel is working with them for an official comic book. But I think, though, that basically their argument is that even though the work is public domain, these titles are infringing upon their trademarks and their ability to sell certain properties in the future because people are going to be confused over it. And I really don't think a judge is going to rule in their favor over that. Public domain infringe upon copyright.
Mm-hmm. You know, the part that made me laugh out loud when I was reading it was the fact that they referred to the books as being borderline pornographic. And the part that made me laugh is that in the original books, these people, the women are particularly naked. They had to actually put some clothing on them so that they could actually make the comics. And so to refer to the comics as pornographic just made me laugh out loud.
It's over the comic.
That's the only reason I ever buy Dynamite titles, because all the female characters are borderline pornographic and barely wearing anything. That's the only reason I buy their comics. Has absolutely nothing to do with the story.
I like the story. Mr. Nelson does a wonderful job on both of those, and I don't want to see him stop doing that. So I agree that this is very likely something they're just doing to say, you're making money, give us a piece of that. And usually these things resolve themselves by giving people a certain amount of money. And that's probably what will happen is Dynamite will probably approach them quietly and say, look, how much is it going to take to get rid of you?
Right.
And they'll probably give an amount, and they'll negotiate, and they'll come down and finally have the right amount. And the Burroughs group will sort of disappear for a while. I mean, they're making the movie, for pity's sake. Aren't they making money off of that? Although I hear bad things about the movie. Maybe that's why they're doing what they're doing. The word is that the movie's not going to do all that well. They've done like preview showings and stuff like that, and people have come away saying that they weren't impressed by the movie. I mean, the effects are fantastic.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention, though, in the earlier Archie story that, yeah, I'm really happy with the way Archie's current management is in terms of bringing certain very forward-thinking and very timely kind of issues, you know, into the forefront. I never really would have thought about Archie like 5 years ago or earlier.
I don't know. you know, Archie, you know, they need to change their art style if they're going to try to be current. Mm-hmm. I mean, Archie runs around with a sweater vest on. Yeah, and he looks, you know, he doesn't look like he belongs in the current world. And yet we've got a gay character, and now we've got the Occupy Riverdale. I just always wonder what that's going to look like in the book. That'll be interesting to see how they actually portray that. They'll just have signs. It'll be the same looking kind of people.
Yeah.
With signs.
The Jill Thompson art piece, it's just a cover art piece, though, but it looks very modern in terms of the way Riverdale would look and the way even Jughead kind of looks.
Yeah.
See, the question I have for you is, if you buy Archie Comics, are you going to want to buy an Archie comic with an Occupy Riverdale in it?
As a collector, maybe, yes. But as a regular fan, their audience is teen and preteen girls. Hard to say.
I can't see anybody. If you like Archie, and Archie, his biggest worry is, where is Jughead going to get his next hamburger? Is he going to decide between Betty or Veronica? I just can't see somebody who's buying Archie or a regular Archie reader wanting to read that. Now, granted, maybe what they're trying to do is expand their audience and say, we want to get other people to read this. But have you lost your base at that point? Have you alienated the people who buy your comic on a regular basis so you can try to attract new people?
Right.
And I don't know. We'll see. I just think this is kind of dumb.
Yeah. People are talking about Archie, though, which is probably the first time in a while since doing the Kevin Keller character.
Yeah. Okay, Gianluca, how about you?
I got a bunch of news for Image Comics Expo 2012. Mm-hmm. By the time people listen to this, Image Comics Expo will be long gone. But in the wake of that, there's some really cool announcements. Daniel Corey, the creator and writer for Moriarty, he's announcing that there's going to be Moriarty the Stage Musical. He's teaming up with composer Raymond Schnurr to create a new musical based on the first miniseries for Moriarty. So that's going to be cool. Raymond Schnurr is also currently working with Neil Gaiman on an adaptation of a stage play. So really cool news on that end.
Before you leave that, Ian, I think you should go out there and audition for the role of Moriarty.
Can you sing?
Yeah, right.
He wanted you to record your voice when we talked to him on the SFP Now broadcast. Nice. He wanted you to record him speaking Moriarty's words, and I thought this might be a chance for Ian to strut his stuff.
Right, Ian.
What it was, when we interviewed Daniel Corey, I read out the opening monologue of Moriarty, you know, where he's talking about what he's been up to and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't put my Mancunian accent onto it, but I kind of put a malevolent sort of voice to it.
All right.
Daniel was impressed. It was sort of like the first time he'd actually heard a British guy read it out to him.
Mm.
Did you ever record that and send that to him?
Well, it wound up in the show.
Okay. Oh, well, that worked out fine. I forgot about that.
Started growing your hair out, Ian.
That's right.
My hair's long anyway, so...
That's true. All right, other news.
Yeah, Image had some other big announcements at the show so far. Grant Morrison is going to be doing a book with Image. Him and Derek Robertson. It's going to be called Happy. And according to Morrison, it's going to be the first of maybe more work with Image. So that's kind of interesting. Frank Quitely and Mark Millarville. Mark Miller is doing a book called Jupiter's Children, and this is another coup because, you know, Mark is usually a Marvel guy. That's why I call him Millarville.
Mm-hmm.
So he's stepping out doing that. That was already announced earlier this year, but they announced that again.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on to another thing, here's another thing on here. We just got done having Ed Brubaker and his artist that works with him. Didn't they go over to Image? Yeah, they did, starting doing Fatale for Image, didn't they?
Yeah, that's been out. I had the first two issues. It's a really good series. It's one of my mm-hmm. best of the weeks whenever.
There's like an exodus going from Marvel, at least their Icon or whatever line it is, and moving over to Image. That's an odd thing.
It is odd. It was funny, too, because that was announced at New York Comic Con. And before I heard the announcement, I was, you know, talking with fans and stuff, and I was like, yeah, I'd love to work with Brubaker, but there's no way in hell he's ever going to leave Marvel and Icon. They pay him way too much money, and blah, blah, blah. And then sure enough, less than a day later, it's like, oh, I'm going to do my Image.
Interesting.
It's an 11-issue series, Fatale is. That's almost a year commitment for Brubaker.
Very interesting. Okay.
And the funny thing about Mark McGarvin is he was announced this week that they're actually starting to shoot Kick-Ass 2, and they're also going to shoot a movie adaptation of his oh, I can't remember the name of the book. It was actually in Clint, something Jesus.
Hmm.
They're going to do a movie about that as well.
Interesting.
those two are going in production this year with a view to get them out there next year.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
A lot more different titles announced by Image. Steve Niles is doing a couple of books, one with Tony Harris called Chin Music, another one with Scott Morse called Crime and Terror. Howard Chaykin is doing a Black Kiss number 2. Brian Wood, who recently left Vertigo, is teaming up with Ming Doyle to do Mara. Then you have Nick Spencer and Riley Rosmo doing a book called Bedlam. And then Planetoid by Ken Gehring. And also there's going to be a new phonogram series called The Immaterial Girl by Kieran Gillen, James McKelvey, and Matt Wilson. Interesting stuff there.
Did they say why they're making this move? Because it just seems to me that it almost has a New 52 feel to it, that they're trying to go out and try to reclaim a part of the market by doing something like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is their 20th anniversary, and this is their big show. So They've kind of been building momentum, as you said. They got Brubaker late last year, and then they have Brian K. Vaughan's saga coming out soon, and apparently that's already sold out, pre-orders. So Image seems to be on the very big move lately. Interesting stuff coming from them.
Good point about the 20th anniversary. I forgot all about that. You're right.
Yeah. In other news, a couple of Marvel news items. After Avengers vs. X-Men comes out, it's been announced that Brian Michael Bendis is going to stop writing the Avengers, and he's going to be starting on the X-Men books. Interesting stuff on that. And then in addition, other news regarding Avengers versus X-Men, and you'll be very interested in this, Wayne, but supposedly, this is rumor, but there's supposedly already 200,000 orders for this book.
And yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by that. They're estimating that that's how much it's going to sell. And, you know, I can understand that. The trick of this is just like with the New 52, is going to be 6 months down the road. How are people going to be looking at this? I mean, right out of the gate, you know, it's going to be a big deal. It's like the New 52. I mean, you know, September was a huge month for DC. The thing's going to be when we hit September after this has started, how is Avengers versus X-Men going to go on? The trick about these Marvel events are people buy them and they keep saying, yes, this one's going to be great. And then we get to the end of it and they go, thank goodness that's over with. You know, House of M nefariously jumps to mind. Oh, my gosh. People were just going like, is this done? Is this over yet? Civil War soured people, too, in some ways.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people who are going, oh, my gosh, is this thing done? One of the things that Avengers versus X-Men, I think, people might get fatigue is that not only is it going to have their own books, but they're also going to go into the regular titles. So if you're going to try to keep up with all this, you've got to buy a mountain of Marvel books.
That's how these big crossover events work. Civil War was the same way. DC is just as guilty with Countdown, 52. Mm-hmm. Even their new 52 books are involving crossovers. So if you want the whole story on what's going on with Justice League Dark, you got to pick up High Vampire and so on and so forth. That's how they work. But, you know, even still, 200,000 or over 200,000, that's going to put them at number one for that particular month. So it'll be interesting to see what the DC Marvel market share is going to be like that particular month.
Well, you reminded me of something I can bring up. Justice League number one has gone to a seventh printing. It's gone to a seventh printing now. Which is pretty amazing when you consider that there are going to be hardcover versions of this and trades obviously coming out. Mm-hmm. There's also that great, great big $150 edition.
52.
Has number one in there. So the thing of it is this book just keeps going on, and the demand for number one just keeps going. And it's interesting to see, but I think it'll be funny to see how this all turns out. Avengers versus X-Men, the inevitable comparison is going to be, how does Avengers versus X-Men do versus New 52? We'll have a monthly, I'm sure as we go through, people will be going, okay, this versus this. September versus the first month of Avengers versus X-Men, we'll probably sit there and talk about how they go against each other. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's good for the industry, I think.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That reminds me, you know, we were talking about Fatale earlier by Brubaker. That's going into a third printing, issue number one, and issue number two is going to a second printing.
Cool.
A lot of cool stuff going around here. And then Image Expo isn't the only convention that's been going on this past weekend. There was also the London Super Comic Convention. IDW had an announcement that Andy Diggle and Mark Buckingham will be creating the first arc of a new Doctor Who series together for later this year, in 2012. So, yeah. Interesting about that is that I was reading stories about this, and, you know, IDW does not have UK rights for Doctor Who. So poor Ian's not going to be able to read this particular issue.
Oh, I will. What happens is the comics ordered them in anyway.
But the interesting aside to that story is that the Star Wars Next Generation Doctor Who spinoff is going to be, like, officially, yeah, you can get anything anywhere nowadays, but that particular book is going to be officially released in London because IDW does own UK rights to Star Wars, and because Star Trek, Star Trek is the first title in the beginning of the announcements, the Star Trek Next Generation Doctor Who crossover, because of that, they're able to distribute this in the UK. Interesting aside there. Nobody has reported this, and hopefully when this goes online, you guys will be the first on this. But Boom Studios and the Kaboom Kids line has Garfield, the cat. It's going to be in the March previews.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Kaboom is doing a wonderful job, I think, in creating a kids line. You know, Adventure Time, we talked about, Peanuts. Yeah, they're doing what I think other companies should have been doing, and that is aggressively going after the kids market, because this is a great thing on several levels. You get to have parents come in and buy the comics, and then you breed a new generation of kids who read comics. So there's just all kinds of good reasons to do these things. And Boom seems to be the only one that really wants to go forward with this. I mean, DC has their line and Marvel's starting theirs, but they're not trying to tie into other properties that are big deals like Adventure Time. I applaud Boom tremendously on doing all these wonderful things, because this is what we need. We need to appeal to younger kids so they grow up knowing what it's like to read a comic and appreciate them. Mm-hmm. My humble opinion, anyway.
Yes.
I want to quickly add to that what you just said about the kids guy. I mean, certainly when I was a kid, we actually had kids' comics on the shelves. And you kind of like read your kids' comics till you got to a certain age, and you naturally progressed onto the older comics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Boom are actually doing a good thing there, as in they're actually trying to pave the way for the next generation of comic readers, in which case we've probably skipped quite a few generations because there's not been anything around for the younger readers.
You know, for me as a kid, I never went to comic book stores. I used to get these kind of comics at grocery stores, newsstands, any kind of place like that. Where I grew up in Memphis, there was maybe 2 comic book stores ever, and you had to go quite out of your way to get to them where I lived. So I'm sure these kind of books are going to be like the Peanuts, just like the Disney books they did before. These are going to be available in newsstands and Barnes & Nobles and stuff like that. So it's really going to get people growing up later on to kind of seek out the comic book stores and finding more adult materials as they grow old.
You just reminded me of something I wanted to mention about the same topic, is the fact that, you know, Marvel got the rights to the Disney books, and they're just sticking their toe in the water. They're doing like a Toy Story one, and then they're supposed to be doing other stuff, but man, they are so slow on the uptake of this. When Kaboom got a hold of this, and I don't think they were called Kaboom that name, but they
Boom Kids at the time,
they put out a massive number of books.
Oh yeah,
you know, Darkwing
New
Duck
and reprint material too.
And see, Marvel's sitting on it. But I hate to say this, Marvel does this all the time. Whenever they get properties that they didn't actually create, they tend to sit back and go, well, we'll get to it. And Boom, to their credit, really launches out to do these things and make things happen.
Yes.
And I just applaud them on this again. I'm so excited about what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's just a great idea.
And they get really good creative teams, too. They just don't pump the stuff out. You had Mark Waid writing The Incredibles. Their Darkwing Duck, the artist for that was really amazing, I remember. And Ian Brill was a good writer for that. Ross Ritchie, the publisher, really has a knack of finding the right guy and the right artist to kind of like work together and create something special.
Mm-hmm. So. Great stuff. Okay, well, why don't we move into the previews then? Ian, why don't we start with you, and what are you looking forward to this week?
Oh, you dropped me in it again.
Okay, right on there. You're too busy listening, and you got to think a little ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want, we can go to Gianluca.
I'm ready for you.
You're born ready.
Star Trek Ongoing's coming out this week. It's the second part of Operation 9-8. Quite looking forward to that. Of course, we've got Lord of the Jungle due out this week through IDW, and Bionic
Dynamite,
Man.
Actually.
also through Dynamite, sorry. Star coming out through IDW, Lord of the Jungle and Bionic Man coming out Dynamite.
Yes.
And for your Buffy fans, Dark Horse is releasing Angel and Faith, issue 7. And I think that is about it for me, really, because there's not anything from DC coming out that's on my pull list. But I've just spotted Batman Beyond Unlimited. I'm just wondering is that like the Batman Beyond that they cancelled last year?
Yes. That's exactly what that's like. What it is there going to be multiple stories within this book? That's why they call it Unlimited. There's going to be a Batman Beyond story coming up. Is going to be one by J.T. Krull where he does Superman Beyond. They're going to have Justice League Beyond in here. So you can get multiple things in what I call the Beyondiverse.
Okay.
Is going to be on.
Well, I'm going to ring the comic store on Monday and sort that out then, because I love the Beyond comic.
Mm. Me too.
Cool.
Okay, Gianluca, how about you?
All right, for February 29th, Leap Year Day, some interesting stuff. Ian already mentioned Lord of the Jungle number 2 from Arvid Nelson and Dynamite. Samurai's Blood Volume 1 trade paperback goes on sale. I highly recommend that if you like Seven Samurais and those kind of stories. Owen Wiseman, the writer for that, is signing at Golden Apple Comics in Los Angeles. So if you're in town, stop on by. We're giving away free first issues as well. And the only other title, it's kind of a weak for me, you know, for the 29th leap year. Boom Studios has a couple of interesting titles. Hellraiser number 11, surely because apparently Clive Barker is returning to write new chapters in this series now. And if you're a fan of the band Coheed and Cambria, the singer for that, Claudio Sanchez, he did a book called The Key of Z, and the trade paperback of that goes on sale also.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Other stuff?
On to you, Wang. Nope.
Okay. There's something really interesting I'm going to be buying. I normally buy the book anyway, but I'm fascinated by Invincible, which is going the Ultimate Spider-Man route. They're taking the main character out and they're putting a black guy in the uniform instead. Now, are they going to be commenting on that trend? Mr. Kirkman is known for doing those kinds of things, so I'm going to be fascinated to see if he's just going to be making allusions towards what Marvel's up to in the Ultimate line. So that fascinates me no end. I am buying a lot of DC books. The aforementioned Batman Beyond Unlimited, the Beyondiverse to me is just I was so certain I was going to hate this thing when the cartoon first appeared and I fell in love with it, so there's just no better thing than that. Multiple printings that are out this week. Justice League number 4, the second printing is out. Justice League number 6, the real first one, is coming out. Shade number 5 of 12. I like Thunder Agents volume 2, number 4 of 6 is coming out. Other than that, Legion, Secret Origin, which I really like. Then there is the Batman Odyssey volume 2, number 5 of 7. If Neil Adams wasn't drawing that, I probably wouldn't be getting that. But then there's the aforementioned Star Trek ongoing, which is really good. Fatale variant cover, third printing, number 1 and number 2 are both out this week. So if you didn't get Fatale's number 1 and 2, this is the week to catch up so you're ready for when
that
comes.
Highly recommend it on my end, yeah.
Yeah, very good. Walking Dead number 94 comes out. That's going a very different direction from the show. Other things, let's see, from Marvel, Venom number 13.4. Hopefully that ends that storyline. I would like for that to end.
What's with Marvel and the point issues?
I think they're trying to say, you collectors out there, we're going to screw you good. How are you going to ever store this stuff?
No, I think it's...
You could never do 14. You have to say like 13.1, 0.2.
Yeah.
I think it's so they can make it look like they're putting out even more comics than DC are, even though they already put out more comics than DC.
Yeah. Well, another one I want to mention, too, Steed and Mrs. Peel number 2 is out this week by Mr. Morrison.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Ooh.
So that'll be good. One for Gianluca for you to ignore is Voltron number 3. That's out this week. So put that on. Just like, that's to you like Last Fandom is to me. I can't read that anymore. But anyway,
Nothing. I'm not going to go on a rant.
Okay. One other one, the Game of Thrones, which is being translated from novel into comic, that's out as well. Clint number 14 finally hits the States, so that'll be out. And I think that's pretty much it. Any other stuff we should talk about before we call it quits? All right. If we have to think about it, we're probably...
I guess not.
Okay. We'll talk with you guys next week, so thanks again, as always.
All right, let's take a look at what's new in your local comic shop. The highlight of the week has to be the Animal Man t-shirt that I just got done talking with Jeff Lemire about. It comes in four different sizes, large, medium, XL, and XXL, and they're $18.95. Believe me, they're worth it, and Animal Man is just a terrific product to support, so get the Animal Man t-shirts. Other product that came out this week included Adam Hughes-inspired Vampirella statue for $189, a Battlestar Galactica Cylon Raider model kit for about $30. Dungeons & Dragons people want to get the Archie Hugo MP3 player for $50. DC Heroes Wave 20 Necron action figure set came out. Disney Princesses 4-pack button set came out, as well as Disney Traditions Mickey Mouse bird feeder statue for a paltry $135. There's also, by the way, the Disney Traditions Mickey Mini heart box. That one's only $35, though. There's also the Disney Villains 4-pack button set. Doctor Who fans will want to get the I'm the Doctor Navy t-shirt, which comes in multiple sizes. There's also Dragon Age Redemption DVD has hit the stores. Futurama Talking Bender figure offered again for $20. Green Lantern X-Ray black t-shirts out as well. There's also the Hell on Earth DVD. Iron Man Armored Avenger armor model kit for $30, as well as My Iron Suit zip-up hoodie for Iron Man. The Justice League Doom Blu-ray and DVD is out in local stores. Great story. If you want to see that my review, just go back to last week's Comics Portal column at scifipulse.net. There's the Lost in Space Pod 124th finished model kit for $50. Marvel Slingers Battle Pack, a Marvel Slingers Starter Pack, Marvel vs. Capcom Minimate Series 2. There's a Rocky 7-inch action figure series. There's a Small World Underground for $50. There's Star Wars Anakin Skywalker lightsaber lamp for $65. You can also get the companion Darth Vader lightsaber lamp for $65 as well. There's a steampunk utility belt. That'll be interesting. Everything must be powered by steam. Superheroes of the Round Table soft cover. There's the Twilight Zone Mystic Seer replica. There's Warehouse 13 Artifact Roadshow t-shirts. And the last of the bunch is the Young Justice DVD Season 1 Part 3. That's out this week. And of course, as infrequently as that show has been running, that'll be good to have. A good word, though, is that it will be starting up very shortly on Saturday mornings with Green Lantern the Animated Series. And those are the things that came into your local store this week. And that's a wrap for the 47th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. You'll want to be back again next week when I talk to another of my favorite DC writers, J.T. Kroll. He's worked on such great projects as Teen Titans and Green Arrow in the past, and he's got some great things coming, including Superman Beyond. So you won't want to miss that. But until next time, keep reading your comics.
So I leave, knowing that a world full of heroes has nothing to fear.